Good afternoon, Your Honors. Robert Lent, appearing pro hoc vici. With me today is local counsel Teresa Locke. Her Colorado number is 26148. My California state bar number is 119965. May it please the court. This case presents a situation where an abuse of discretion occurred by the district court in issuing its permanent orders, which after a hearing on March 29th and March 30th of 2010. A division of property in this case did not occur, which was in violation, in contravention, of Colorado Revised Statute 14-10-113. What is a division of property? It's a very good question because there is no definition in the statute itself. We know what a division of property is not. It is not awarding an asset that has no value, or at the very best, an illusory value that was not based on any evidence adduced at the hearings itself. Division of property is certainly not a situation where an asset is awarded to one of the parties, but the other party maintains sole control over the asset, sole possessory control, and sole ownership control. In this case, appellee was the sole person on the mortgage on the L.A. house. That house subsequently went into foreclosure and was sold at auction. That sale was unpreventable by appellant.
When did the house go into foreclosure?
Went into foreclosure, I believe, in December of 2010.
Yeah, so was that after the orders were issued?
Yes.
So there's nothing in the record on the on that set of facts?
There is reference in the reply brief to the fact, but it had not.
No, I mean, in the trial court.
On the record itself, there is nothing in the record to say that it was in default at that time, because it wasn't.
Okay.
Appellant had no control over his ability to save the house in any way, shape, or form, because appellee was the only person on the mortgage. The bank wouldn't speak to him concerning the house.
Mr. Lent, did the court award full ownership to one of the parties?
Yes, to appellant. But it awarded ownership, but not the means to accomplish that ownership. And that's one of the reasons we're here today.
The allegation that the bank wouldn't talk to him, is that in the record? Or
no.
This is all post?
Right, this is all post.
Okay.
And it is hoped that if a remand is ordered, that it would be a consideration of the economic circumstances that the district court could take it into account.
How was the actual title held in the California house?
The title in the California house was held jointly.
But only and they could was on they could foreclose a mortgage without notice to the other owner?
They didn't have to give notice to the appellant because he wasn't on the mortgage, and they refused to discuss the matter with him. And appellee took no steps to save the house from mortgage.
In Colorado, you can't foreclose on someone who has a title interest without giving him notice. I take it that's not the law in California?
That's not the law in California, no, where the residence was located. So what the order itself...
Again, we have nothing in the record about any of this, right?
Right. But the permanent orders itself created a situation where a joint tenancy in both properties, the L.A. house and in the Vail house, were created and maintained. And indeed, the Vail house, which was awarded to appellee, is in joint tenancy. And that has not been resolved either as of today's date. So in one sense, the information concerning the L.A. house and the Vail house are both in the record because they were a subject of concern, I gather, to the district court judge because he made his orders on what the valuation of each house was. And that's another error that occurred. In connection with the L.A. house, there was no appraisal ever done on the house.
Didn't the husband file a financial statement saying it was worth $1.5 million?
No, the $1.5 million was taken from the listing price of the house at the time of the mediation.
Well, that was not in the husband's financial statement?
I don't believe so. And the district court merely deducted out the amount of the mortgage from the list price of the house, determining that there was $225,000 in equity in the house. There was no other evidence in the record as to the value of equity in the house except for one item, and that was appellee's own testimony that there was $420 in equity in the house. Nevertheless, the district court awarded to appellant $225,000 in equity that did not exist. What has happened then in connection with both houses is that joint tenancies in both have been maintained, both under the case law in Ray Paul, in Ray Garrick. That is a situation that violates the statute and the meaning of whatever the meaning is of dividing the assets or dividing the property, because we are both the appellant and the appellee are still joined at the hip on both of these houses, even though the one house has been lost to the bank. That situation still maintains itself in connection with the Colorado house, the Vail house, which was awarded.
What was the alternative that was proposed by husband to what you're complaining about?
I'm not sure I understand, Your Honor.
You're not happy with the way that, as I understand it, the court gave them a five-year period to do right. The refinance. What alternative was presented by husband to that proposal?
The alternative that was presented at the time was it was anticipated that because of the court's language that Appellee would take steps to put the house in his name, either to quit claim it to him, to refinance it, to pay off the mortgage, or allow him to speak to the bank. None of that was done.
That was proposed to the trial court and then rejected it?
That was never proposed at the trial court itself.
Okay.
Because it only came about as a result of the permanent orders. And because of the comments that had been made at the lower court, it was determined that the appellant would be better off taking the matter up on appeal than going back in front of the trial court, the district court, and seeking a modification.
Mr. Lent,
sure.
Now in reading Appellee's brief, it's my understanding that Appellee is contending that the court, by awarding ownership of the home, in effect, that terminated the joint tenancy, and I'd like to hear your response to that.
It did not terminate the joint tenancy, because if there had been a true joint tenancy, steps would have been taken so that we could at least discuss the matter with the bank and hopefully have saved the house that had been distributed to appellant. But none of that was done, and as such, there was no way for us to control the final outcome of that. So even if you assume that the valuation of the house was correct at the beginning, which it wasn't, even if you assume that a division of property actually occurred, it was an illusory division, both under the holdings in Garrett and in Ray Paul, because there was no value in the house and there was no way for us, the appellant, to meaningfully go about trying to save the house or do anything with respect to that house. We're faced with the same situation today with the Vail house. Although it was awarded to Appellee, it's in joint tenancy. The order, because of its vagueness, ambiguity, and uncertainty, has created a situation where we are going into the future still conjoined with Appellee in this process. This, in our opinion, is a violation of the Colorado Revised Statutes, the case law thereunder, and public policy. Public policy here has been violated, because the public policy behind the statutes, my reading of the legislative intent, was to create a situation where the parties can go forward separately, maintain their own separate lives, and go forward and prosper.
Here, I ask you a somewhat unrelated question, if I may. I was confused on this. Mr. Wisner testified, as I understand it, that Planet Hollywood owed him $500,000 of funds that I guess were deposited with him.
Correct.
And he was awarded whatever amount that is as part of the property division, was he not?
Correct.
Was that taken into account?
I believe it was taken into account, but it hasn't been collected. It's a contingent asset, so to speak.
But it's still an asset that he says is a $500,000 asset, and that was awarded to him.
Yes, and we're taking steps to get that back, but that wasn't a hard asset in the terms of the hard assets that were awarded to Appellee in connection with her pension plan, her 401k plan, the Corvette, the timeshare. And I would like to make
simply in the matter of the valuation, that would be a significant item, would it not? In terms of, you indicate that 19% of the total assets is all she was in reality.
It would if it were collected.
He was in reality awarded.
But they contest that it's not owed by them. Planet Hollywood contests that it's not owed by them. So we would have to commence a lawsuit to collect it. Okay. And I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Is that okay?
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Ann Gill. My registration number is 14610. I'm appearing on behalf of Laura Leitzinger, the former wife in this case. The trial court properly divided the property in this case. It exercised its discretion and went through the property very carefully. It identified separate property, then went through the marital assets and awarded one house to each of the spouses. And that order severed what had previously been a joint tenancy. The court allowed the parties 5 years to refinance the mortgages on each property in light of the fact that at that time neither of them was employed. The testimony concerning that was the wife testified that she thought she could do a refinance in two. The court very generously allowed them 5 years. The appellant has not challenged the length of time allowed for the refinancing of these properties, but that is what is fairly common, to allow a former spouse a period of time to do a refinance after a property is awarded and there is a mortgage that had been in joint names or perhaps only one name. But in this case, the trial court properly exercised its discretion in doing this. This case is not at all like either the Garrett or Paul cases, in which the property division prolonged or continued a joint ownership of assets and required the ongoing relationship of the spouses after the divorce. In the Garrett case, the court allowed them maintain the co-ownership. In Paul, there was the wife had a partnership with her siblings, and the trial court had stated that she and her former husband would share in various calls or distributions, and that if the interest in the partnership ultimately was sold at some point in the indefinite future, that at that time it had a formula for distribution. That is quite distinguishable from the situation we have, in which title has already been conveyed to each of the former spouses, and it's just a question of having time to get the mortgage into the individual name.
Ms. Gill, so you're making a distinction between whether or not there is title that has been divided or whether there has been a division in the financing.
Yes, and I think that's a highly appropriate, particularly with real property, because once one has the title, then one can do whatever one wants with the financing. And I would disagree with opposing counsel's argument about what's going on here, because it's not at all uncommon once in a divorce, there is a permanent order awarding property to one of the spouses, who then has to do a refi of the mortgage to take the other spouse's name off it. Is to simply to go to a bank, a mortgage company, or whomever with the permanent order and say, I own this, I have to get the financing in place, and they work through that and pay off the previous loan, and they may not have to get it a replacement loan, the refinancing with the same institution. They can go anywhere they want to do their refinancing. It's not a question of having permission to speak to the former institution that had the original mortgage at all.
Saying that the permanent orders effect a severance of the joint tenancy?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there doesn't need to be any need for issuance of cross deeds on the property or anything like that?
I think the permanent orders do that. I would assume that when there's a refinance, that there may a financial institute may request a quit claim deed, but traditionally the permanent orders have been all that's needed to effectuate that. Here at the two-day hearing that led to these permanent orders, the husband testified that the Planet Hollywood debt did have a value of $500,000. He also testified as to value of the Williams lawsuit that is further supported by his position in the party's joint statement that was filed 5 days before the permanent orders hearing. There's also information in that joint statement as to the value of the properties, in which they identify the amount of the mortgages on the LA house and the fact that it's listed for sale at $1,525,000. So there is a evidence before the trial court to support its determination of value, and it is in the discretion of the trial court to make that determination as to the value, and with evidence in the record that is well within the trial court's discretion.
So the only evidence of the value was the amount, the listing price?
Yes. Okay. And if the husband had wanted to say it was otherwise, he was free to get an appraisal and present that information. He did not do so.
Well, that was uncontradicted evidence then.
That is my understanding, that this was the uncontradicted as to the listing price and the amount of the outstanding mortgages.
Gil, let me ask you about the $420, I believe, that wife had in a financial statement as representing the equity.
She did make that statement in a financial statement, is my understanding. But then, as I was just referencing the joint statement, they did not identify specifically equity, but did put out the other information. I think this was in the trial court's discretion to determine which way it wanted to value the property, and it chose to do it in this manner. And I think that with this evidence in the record, that's well within the court's discretion. And it is kind of curious to note that now husband is arguing that what the trial court did continued the joint tenancy in the two houses, but that's exactly what he had asked the court to do as to the Hawaii timeshare and the joint statement that was submitted to the court. He wanted to continue joint ownership and swap year on, year off on use of the timeshare. So it is a little bit contradictory that now he finds seeing a joint tenancy as such a bad thing when he did urge it for the timeshare. There is evidence in the record, both in the testimony at the hearing and in the party's joint statement, to support the value of the various assets of the property. The trial court did specifically state that it was weighing the evidence and did not give credence to all of the evidence presented to it. It was within the court's discretion to make those judgment calls. That is what the trial court is supposed to do, to judge, and that is what it did here. It determined that the assets that were before the court for division had been primarily accumulated by wife, and it determined it would be equitable to give a majority of those assets to wife. This was an appropriate exercise of the court's discretion, and I ask you to affirm what the trial court did in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Contrary to counsel's representations, I defy counsel to cite one case where 5 years is a reasonable amount of time to finally dispose of an asset that's awarded at permanent orders hearing. I have scoured the law, and I have found nothing, no case whatsoever, that allows 5 years as a reasonable time. And I submit to you, it is not a reasonable time on its face. It takes far less time than that to resolve this whole matter. In fact, the district court could have ordered that appellee quit claim her interest within 10 days, within a month, within 3 months. 5 years is just unconscionable and defies public policy. And again, going back to what I was saying earlier, in trying to separate the parties, reduce or eliminate the amount of animosity and contentiousness, reduce or eliminate the prospects of litigation in the future, and allow everyone to go forward.
Sir, Mr. Lent, maybe you can clarify this for me, because I do understand the public policy argument of not requiring the parties to continue on in financial arrangements following the decree. The cases that I have looked at here and that you've cited before us discuss ownership interests in property, real property, and that a court may not indefinitely postpone dividing those ownership interests. In this particular case, it looks to me like the trial court order does divide the ownership interests, but it is the debts owing on those properties that is requiring refinancing. And have you found any authority that addresses the debts?
No, not per se, Your Honor, but I can tell you that under California law, and contrary to what counsel has stated, she stated that when you are on title, you can do your own financing and do pretty much whatever you want. That's not the case under California law. Under California real estate law, which I'm familiar with, the fact that you're on title, if you're not on the promissory note, the bank will foreclose on you, and they will do whatever they want to, and then try to clear title later. Meaning, in the interim, the situation is you're evicted from your home, which happened to appellant in this case. So that's not the case under California law, nor did the district court even bother to look into how title was held when the permanent orders were constructed. There was no dialogue at all in the record, you'll find none, that states who was on title, how it was held, who was on the mortgages. There is just blanket assertions that you get this house, you get that house, and if you happen to be on the mortgage, then you will do certain things. I can cite from the permanent orders, but you have those, Your Honor, and I won't waste time doing that.
Did defendants present that evidence?
I'm sorry?
You're saying there's no evidence on certain issues, and I'm asking you whether or not the husband, presented that evidence.
There was no evidence presented one way or the other about who was on title, and there was no inquiry made.
Thank you.
And I submit to you, Your Honor, that such an inquiry must have been made by the district court in order to fashion and craft an order such as he did. Otherwise, it has no meaning. And I think what has happened here is maybe there was a confusion on the part of the district court with respect to the effect of California real estate law and Colorado real estate law. But they're definitely distinct in this case. With regard to the amount of the equity in the property, there was no appraisal done, as I said, and there was no evidence in the record as to what the equity value was, except what appellee put in the record herself, the $420. The fact that the listing price of the house was $1.55 million and there was $1.29 million owing on the debt itself doesn't create equity. That tells me there was no analysis done whatsoever, just simple math, deducting the debt on the mortgage held solely by appellee from the listing price itself, coming up with $225,000 that was not there.
You would agree that husband did not adduce any evidence himself as to the value?
No, there was no evidence adduced as to what the value of the house was. There was on the Vail house, there was an appraisal done. So with that, I would just encourage the court to look at these issues, as I know it will, and consider whether remand is appropriate for orders consistent with the arguments that we put forward here today. In connection with trying to come up with an order from the district court that ends this ongoing entanglement, financial entanglement, that the parties are currently undergoing and will undergo for the next 3.5 years. So to the extent that we can undo this and allow the parties to go forward separately, I think that would suggest that would be consistent with public policy. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. And the